Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. I will hereby call this January 12, 2017 meeting of the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority to order. Ms. Spear, would you please, no, we're going to go out of order, actually. Let me do this. I'm going to move this up. I'll move it up a lot. I'm going to jump for a moment before we even call the roll. Can we do that? Can we take action before we call the roll?
Call the roll.
Chairman Noe?
Here.
Chair Randall?
Here.
Chairman Bulova?
Here.
Chair Fassett?
Here.
Mayor Silverberg?
Here.
Mayor Parrish?
Here.
Mayor Stombres? Councilmember Snyder? Mayor Michelle?
Here.
Senator Black? Delegate Hugo? Delegate Minshew? Ms. Hines?
Here.
Mr. Cole?
Here.
Mayor Burke?
Yeah. No, she's not. She can't call on the roll yet. That's why I was going to take the phone.
Ms. Cuervo? Mr. Horses?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you. Now we will jump, we'll shuffle things around a bit and jump to, we're going to jump to item number 13, action item, the appointment of a town representative for calendar year 2017. The Coalition of Town Mayors has requested that we appoint newly elected Leesburg Mayor Kelly Burke.
Thank you.
To this position. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Now let the minutes show that Ms. Burke has arrived at the meeting. Okay. Next item is the minutes of the December 8th meeting. These were sent out in advance, yes?
Yes.
Any questions, comments, changes?
Mr. Chairman, move approval.
Second.
All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Aye.
Our motion carries unanimously. Does anyone need to record as an abstention? Ms. Batten?
I think Chair Fassett does, because he wasn't Chair Fassett last time.
So, that's his choice.
It never bothered me.
Board Member Fassett was here. okay. Annual report. Very exciting.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of information, or point of order. We do have public comment here in the future organization.
But it's not on the agenda.
It is. It's way at the top.
Oh, but she didn't put it down here. She didn't make it really easy. I'm a rules follower. Okay. Okay, so we have, this is our annual meeting, our annual organizational meeting at which we have citizens' time. We have one person signed up who called this evening to cancel. So Nancy Smith of the Northern Virginia Transportation Alliance signed up and canceled. Since no one signed up, Mr. Whitfield, go ahead. Even though you didn't sign up, I'm going to give you your 3 minutes.
I appreciate
it. You think Nancy's time.
I didn't see. I sent Monica an email today, which she didn't get. So it's working. It doesn't matter. I'm Rob Whitfield, Fairfax County Taxpayers Alliance. You've done a lot of good work in the last year. Thank you. The biggest concerns I have are to do with WMATA, in which you're only tangentially involved. I've been to about 50 WMATA board meetings in the last 5 years, and if you hear from the news reports tonight, you hear that some of the issues they're addressing are very serious, but how this organization gets involved in that, I'm not sure, because you're involved in the specific project funding. But within what you have been responsible for, I-66 is most significant project which we have to address. And though it's not your doing, it's that of the governor and the Virginia Department of Transportation, I have to say that I am hugely worried that the public-private project partnership agreement reached by the Commonwealth could result in tolls over the next 50 years of some $6 billion. We're obviously very familiar with what happened with the Dulles Rail Project. So in other words, even though the capital costs are something like $2.5 billion, instead of using conventional financing means, which might have added $500 million or $1 billion, we've got something in which it's been loaded like a Christmas tree, and it includes this bicycle trail, pedestrian bike trail between the Beltway and Gainesville or wherever. And some of those elements haven't been scored. So I confess, even though I've been to many meetings, I don't have detailed knowledge. We certainly don't know the toll revenue forecasts, because when I got on Ask the Governor WTOP back in November, and I asked a couple of questions, I asked the governor to explain, how is this a $2.5 billion taxpayer benefit? He didn't answer my question. Now, again, this is not your responsibility, but what is of importance is that they've spoken in terms of returning the $300 million in revenue, because the selected contractor intends to provide $500 million to the Commonwealth up front. So I don't know, I missed your December meeting because I thought it was at 7 o'clock, and so I don't know what you've decided, what plan of action, what projects will be funded under the return funds, but I am very concerned that as structured, the tolls will be a huge burden to moderate and low-income residents who have to use that toll road. Yes, I know we have the option to use the free lanes, but I hope that we're going to get something from the Commonwealth shortly.
Thanks, sir. Any other citizens who'd like to take advantage of public comment time? Hearing none. Now we will go to the 2016 annual report. I'm very excited.
Oh, yes it is, Mr. Chairman. This will be the third, well, this is the third annual report that we've generated for the authority. I did want to go over some of the major accomplishments that the authority has for 2016, starting with unanimous adoption of your FY 2017 program, which included 12 multimodal projects totaling $446 million. All of your member jurisdictions met the requirements to receive the 30% funds, which is a huge deal. We're excited about that. The revenue distribution funds to the localities, the 30%, is approximately $95 million for 2016. We had groundbreakings at the West Ox Bus Garage and Loudoun County's Belmont Ridge Road Project. We had some ribbon cuttings, the City of Fairfax's Germantown Road Project, and Loudoun County buses. And again, one of the biggest undertakings is the continuous public involvement activities regarding the transaction update. And you'll hear a little more about that following the presentation on the annual report. But just flipping through the annual report, there are certain pages that I wanted to draw your attention to. And let's skip to 8 and 9, because that's the pages 8 and 9, if you will, show the map of all of the projects that you have funded to date. So this map is from FY 2014 to 2017. You have three funding programs, your 2014 program, 2015-16 program, and your 2017 program. So if you look at this map, you'll see all of the projects funded to date. What I do want to note on the key of the map, the road projects are noted in red and your transit projects are noted in blue. And we really do have a balanced approach regarding the road and highway funded projects. Flipping the page, the regional revenues, I want to get to. Yes, flipping the page, the regional revenues and funding allocations, if you can look at the pie chart, it shows for fiscal year 16 all of the regional revenues received, and we've broken it out by tax type, and we even show the interest generated on the regional revenues. If you look at the table one on this page, you'll see the FY 2016 tax revenue and 30% local distribution funds per jurisdiction. Table 2 shows your 2017 program. Now, the meat and potatoes of this annual report really is the centerfold map. We have the maps present to my left, your right, for some of you. It is the map that has the blue background is the map of your FY 2017 program. What we did this year is map the projects that the localities are funding with the 30% revenues. We get a lot of questions here at the authority regarding, well, what are the localities doing with their 30%? We'll turn to this map and you will see what the localities are doing with the 30% revenue. So we wanted to make sure that we showed you, and in some of the projects you will see are using both 70 and 30% revenues, and others are not. Again, there are different requirements in some cases regarding the use of the 30% versus the 70% revenues. And again, we also want to show, in addition to the HB 2313 revenues, the authority has programming responsibility for CMAQ and RSTP funds, and that's really usually about $66 to $70 million per year, so that is also a significant funding source, if you will, to advance projects here in Northern Virginia. Not to take up too much time, but I did want to note pages 18 and 19. Transaction update and public engagement. When we kicked off the update of transaction, and I believe it was fall of 2015, one thing we wanted to do was make sure that public engagement, public involvement is continuous. We didn't just want to go out to the public when we had a draft plan and solicit input. We wanted the public to help develop the plan and develop the plan with us. So we've had a lot of activity regarding public outreach for transaction, to the point we had a kickoff. We had a spring initiative where we were at fairs, malls, churches, senior citizens facility. We wanted to go to the people instead of asking the people to come to us. You'll hear a little more regarding the fall activities. I don't want to steal Susan's thunder, but we did note that in the annual report, the activities to date. Turning to page 20, just give a visual picture and depiction of a lot of the projects that you're advancing with the regional revenue. Again, we're making a dent in congestion reduction, and in addition to congestion reduction, there are additional benefits that the region realizes with the projects that the authority has advanced. To date, the total is $990 million. Now, on all of your projects, you had 79 projects totaling $990 million. I guess I was about to say we have 8 completed projects, but now we have 9 completed projects. So we are at 70 active projects. The projects are in various stages of advancement, but this is really your year in review, and I hope it's that you guys are proud of yourselves.
I'm very proud. So I'm gonna make an observation. I love this. Right. These 4 pages here. This is great. And I'm reminded of the very first public outreach we did back in like about 6 hours after the governor signed the bill in 2013, when Doug Fall, the vice chairman of our TAC, was at a meeting. He came to this one of our meetings and he kept talking. He has 3 minutes. And he kept talking about how he wants to see the big map. He wants to see the big map of all the problems we're going to solve. And I'm like, Doug, we can't show you the map. We haven't decided which problems we're going to solve. And I love that we now have like the big map of the problems we're going to solve.
Absolutely. And we will have this. We sent it to the GA members, but we'll post this to the website in a flip book so that people can view it electronically. And we do have a lot of hard copies. Please feel free to take them with you and you as well.
First of all, I think this is awesome also, and the blue map is great, but it next to the green map, that's a new way of showing how all of our revenues, both the local as well as the regional, are being put to work. A question about the electronic map. When people go to that map, can you, for instance, click on the various projects and get more information?
We're working on that. That's a feature we would like to build into next year's annual report so that it can pop up instead of reading some of the text.
Right. That would be wonderful. Excellent. Really, really nice job. Great picture.
And if I could, Chairman Bulova, I do want to thank Tom Wampler, who works for Fairfax County. Tom, what department is he in? But he really helped us on these maps. And when we had changes and tweaks, he did it no problem. And we want to thank him for that.
Just to say, I think the first meeting I attended about a year ago, we were looking at this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to thank you personally for the moderation you've exhibited with only 43 photos.
If you want your picture, it show up in the ground reference.
it's a good step in the right direction.
In the right direction. I'll make an observation. So I've been told. I have no first-hand knowledge of this, but I've heard urban legends that back in the day, you could go into like auto repair shops, and the auto mechanics would have the center folds of magazines torn out and hung on the wall. I expect to see this in every... Because this is really sexy.
This is the only page you're not on.
Wait, there's a different version of it.
Watch it.
Note that for next year.
One of the projects literally runs right by my house, and that's actually what my eyes grabbed. It was like, yeah, there's one my house would be, right? It's the project. It's all personal. Excellent. Thank you very much. This is great. Okay. Transaction update. Mr. Jasper, where are you?
So, Mr. Chairman, before Keith begins, I do want to know, piggybacking off of what I previously stated regarding the continuous nature and continuous public involvement initiatives that we want to make sure that we're focusing on regarding the transaction update. We charged the consultants to bring us something new, something different, something that really would make the people, incite them to provide comments. We've actually seen a few elected officials at some of our pop-up events. We had about 17 pop-up events throughout the region. We did have, in addition to just citizens that were in the area, hey, what's going on? We asked the question, what's your transportation problem? And we did get a lot of interesting feedback. This helps us because we oftentimes, we hear from the stakeholders, but it's difficult to get the voice of the true citizen until we are on the tail end of the plan. And it's like everyone else, they want to make sure that they're being heard. And we received a lot of interesting feedback. This past fall, we had an online survey, and I think we received about 2,700 respondents to that online survey. So having said that, I'll turn it over to Keith and Sharon to talk about some of the public involvement activities. We did have a brief discussion at your planning and programming committee regarding some of the public involvement initiatives, and we had to cut the discussion off because we had to move on to other items. So this is why we wanted to bring this to the full authority.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to say very little for once. I'd just like to introduce Joyce Seepers. Joyce Seepers from AECOM, who's our consultant for development of the transaction update. She's deputy project manager, but she's actually the mastermind behind all of the public engagement work that we've done over the past year. And to her left, Susan Sharp from Sharp & Company, which is her company, who many of you may be familiar with through all of the outstanding communications work she does for jurisdictions in Northern Virginia and actually the District of Maryland as well. Susan's team has really led the charge in executing the public engagement work and together with Joyce processed the results. And I'm going to hand it over to Susan. She's going to go through the presentation and the rest of us will answer questions if you have any.
And feel free, if you have questions at any time, feel free to stop Susan and we'll make sure we answer.
Sure. Well, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you about your citizens and how we got them involved in this project. So this is an update about the engagement that we've done both in the spring of 2016 and the fall. Our first effort in early spring this year was just to gain awareness among citizens, and then in the fall, it had more to do with obtaining some technical feedback from them. So that was why we engaged with folks. Who did we engage with? In the spring, we went out, we actually had t-shirts made, what's your transportation problem, and we went out to a number of events where we interacted with the public and got over 1,400 responses. This fall, we went with some different techniques, which I'll go into in a little more detail, and we were able to reach over 2,700 responses just to our survey, as well as some other ways in which we engaged. We did this electronic survey for a period of about 6 weeks. It just closed right after Thanksgiving. We did 4 focus groups where we spoke in detail with 40 Northern Virginians. We had 2 workshops at GMU, one in Arlington and one in Fairfax, where we had a chance to meet with about 40 millennials and talk to them. We did a stakeholder workshop here at MBTA with the business community and some associations, many of whom were interacting with MBTA for the first time, such as AARP. And then we did, as part of the survey, we actually took the survey out at pop-in events for senior centers and to some groups that are normally not represented. For instance, we went to the Eden Center in Arlington with a Vietnamese translator who could take the survey and sit down with citizens and do it right there. We had a lot of observations from people about Northern Virginia travel. It's congested. They told us that. You can see here some of their various comments that they made. This shows you one of the events that we did in the spring where we actually had people diagram out for us where they start their trip and where they arrive at work. Spring awareness, I'll just go through very quickly. You can see we did it in Spanish and in English. Again, we did events at various places using a whole series. It was a very interactive set of boards that we had displayed for people where they could put a lot of information up for us to get. This was one of our favorite. What one thing would you change about transportation in Northern Virginia? And I would say that this is about halfway through one of our events. So we had about twice as many post-its by the time it was all done. Interesting finding there, about 72% of respondents conduct their non-work trips by car. We learned a lot about the transportation problems that they see in the area, what they want to see happening. We sort of broke it out into these areas, and you can look at all of this in much more detail. In the fall, we decided to do a kind of online as well as on-the-ground approach and really see if we could engage more people in this activity. So we took this online survey, and what we did this time, in addition to promoting it through e-blast to your stakeholder list and through promotions in that kind of way, posting it on the MBTA website, we did a whole Facebook promotion with it. And we actually brought in 50,000 eyeballs that would not have been there before. We consider that we got a whole lot more likes on the website. We had over 25,000 views of the MBTA website. It was a whole different group of people than had been engaged previously. We supplemented that, as I said, with these pop-in events where we took the survey out to people who normally aren't electronically based on things. And then we did these workshops and focus groups that even gave us a more granular understanding of how people look at things. What was really interesting, we asked people to give us input on how they would measure transportation progress. And what was interesting was how remarkably consistent it was across the board. No matter what jurisdiction, however we sliced and diced it, whatever the jurisdiction, whatever the event, whatever the age group, whatever the sex, anything. These were the priority measures that they came up with, just consistently across the board. They want to reduce delays during commute hours. They want to increase travel time reliability throughout the day, increase the number of travel options, increase access to rail, and increase connections between business and residential centers. The only kind of location-based measures, the difference was that outside the Beltway, there's a little more emphasis on improving roadway safety to reduce vehicular crashes. That's because those get in their way and they can't get their commute done as well. And on the inside, reduce crowding on bus and rail, again, because these are the people who are using bus and rail, and by the time they get on bus and rail, it's crowded and they can't get a seat. Some of the lower priority measures were to reduce the impacts of transportation on the environment, probably because they already think that's happening. Reduce transportation costs, although in other things, they really were pretty supportive of transportation costs. and interestingly reduced SOVs during peak hours. We found that interesting because what they really are saying is they want everyone else's SOV off the road so that they can do it. We had the same thing with transit in the focus groups that people were like, we've got to support Metro. We've got to help Metro because I really want everyone on Metro so I can drive my car. This was a pretty consistent response. One of the things we asked them in the focus group was to diagram or to write down what comes to mind when they think of the term congestion, and you can see these word clouds as well as some of the comments that they came up with. Again, you know, traffic, the inside and outside did not have an enormous difference. What's interesting is when you ask people about improvements, it immediately becomes very specific. You know, I want the road by my house widener. We need a traffic light here. There's not enough bike ped here. So it's interesting, the measures they could deal with on a more abstract level, but the improvements became much more localized. So this is kind of by area in terms of what improvements really stood out. We asked people, you know, to rate what things they would like to see. And so this just kind of, I'm not going to read all of them to you, but each one kind of highlights in that particular area what we heard from the public. So what were some of the big ideas that came out of this? One of the really interesting things is your citizens have a regional outlook. They use the region. In the survey, we asked people to identify where they live, but we also gave them 8 areas to comment on. We had broken the region down into 8 areas. And you did not have to answer all of them. You could pick and choose. Most people answered multiple areas. They live, they work, they go for entertainment, their medical appointments. They use this region, and they want regional solutions. They also want innovative approaches. That matters to them a lot. They know that there need to be investments that are both big and small. They're not afraid of that, but they really want to see things done. So in the spring of 2016, when we asked, what's your transportation problem? It's not easy to get around the region. In the fall of 2016, how should congestion be reduced? Providing greater reliability and options will help solve the problem. They understand that these are not just transportation solutions. They want to see technology solutions. They want to see some flexibility in working arrangements. The citizens understand that this is a growing area and that transportation infrastructure, it's going to be a challenge for it to keep up. But the citizens in Northern Virginia really care about transportation. They had suggestions like we'd like to see a regional website where we could get information on all the projects. I'm a communication person, so of course my ears perked up with the number of people who said we're not communicated with enough. People are not telling us enough about these projects, what's going on, how to get information, all of these kinds of things. And lastly, they really appreciated the opportunity to provide input. I would say that about a third of the comments that we got in the just general, if you have any comments about this, were thank you so much for this opportunity. Nobody's ever come to me and asked me this before, which of course we have, which told us that we were getting a new group of people who we haven't been getting in other surveys. So we're very proud of the work that we did, and thank you all for the opportunity, and I hope this gives you some useful information.
Any questions?
And forgive me if you all know this already, but on your map on page 3, I noticed that you did 2 sites in Loudoun. They were on the very eastern edge, almost in Fairfax County. Was there a reason you didn't go into western Loudoun at all? Because those are 2 very different communities. Their transportation needs are so much different.
If I may have a go at answering that first, we actually did plan to go to an event in Purcellville. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, on the day of the event, the weather forecast was such that the organizers were beginning to change the arrangements, which led us to conclude that we would be stuck out in the rain in a parking lot when everyone else was inside the building. And we figured that for the safety of our staff and for the protecting the exhibits we were using, but mostly because we didn't they would get any foot traffic going past us, that it wasn't going to work for us that day. So it was our intent, but we really just got rained out. I mean, I certainly think through the online survey, you know, that was ubiquitous across the region. There was not constrained. I don't have any numbers with me to hand, but you know, there was good representation all across the album.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Thank you very much. This works. Okay, consent agenda. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 items on the consent agenda. Anything we need to pull? Any questions? So there's a motion for approval.
Second.
Motion by Ms. Randall, second by Ms. Bullivant. All in favor, please say aye.
Comment, please. With regard to the consent agenda, and particularly item 10 on the consent agenda, which has to do with investment safety and investment services, during the most recent finance committee, of course, we found out that EB&T was going to be recommended for the investment safety thing. And I have a potential conflict of interest there as I sit on the advisory board for EB&T Prince William County. And as a result, I will disclose that and not vote on that one item. I do intend to support the balance of the consent agenda, but I'll ask Ms. Spear to make it shown in the minutes that I've both disclosed and abstained from item number 10.
That's that. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much. Going on to action items. We've done number 13. Mayor Burke, welcome aboard. Item 14, tender project agreement for MUMATA regional funding, Green Line traction power upgrades. Mr. Long.
Chairman Noy, if I could, the action on your consent agenda approved the SCAs for the 3 Fairfax County projects. We put this one on as a regular agenda item instead of consent because there are some contingencies associated with the WMATA SPA for the traction power upgrade. I do want to know, pending your approval of this particular item, that all of the standard project agreements as part of the FY2017 program will have taken action on, except the I-66 Route 28 interchange, and of course, we're not advancing that project at this time.
Thank you. As Ms. Backman stated, the authority approved this project as part of the 2017 program. The attached SBA was presented by the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority and is consistent with the project description, and it has been reviewed by the Council of Councils, noting there were no legal issues, which then brings up the question, why did we pull it off consent? We pulled it off consent because the WMATA staff have been very cooperative. This body expressed some concerns on timing of and matching funds. And WMATA passed two resolutions, resolution 2015-66, noting the applications for the NBPA funding as subject to a future decision by WMATA as to whether the project will receive the necessary matching funds. And it noted that WMATA formally approves the project as part of the FY17 annual work plan that includes the necessary matching funding for the project. Additionally, they passed a second resolution, 2016-48, that notes the conditional approval of the project and increase in funding not related to NBTA, but to funding from the District of Columbia in Maryland for the capital improvement plan for 17-22. What all this, to boil it down, there are contingencies within their resolutions, and we just want to make sure the authority is aware and the WMATA staff is aware. We will be looking to make sure the contingencies are fulfilled as their project reimbursements come in. That is the most expeditious way of handling this without waiting for action to actually occur. So it just puts, quite frankly, make sure WMATA knows that, you know, their reimbursement is going to be contingent upon the contingencies in these two resolutions being fulfilled. And I would point out that we took great notice of the authority's resolution 14-8, which basically requires us to make sure that this occurs when multi-jurisdictional funding is in place. So really, we're not presenting a problem. We just want to make sure that everybody knows we actually work with the WMATA staff. We're presenting a solution. And since we do our project funding on a reimbursement basis, everybody is aware that reimbursements from the authority will be contingent upon the contingencies in the two resolutions being fulfilled.
Next question. Is this the first time that Resolution 14-8 has been relevant to the adoption of an SPN?
No, we had, it's part of your FY14 program, you funded 8-car traction power upgrades for the Orange Line, and you funded 8-car traction power upgrades again for the Orange Line as part of your FY2015-16 program.
So we had the Orange Line upgrades, though, that first one was before Policy 14-8 was in place.
Yes, I believe
so,
it was.
So that second round, though, it was in place. We just didn't discuss it in this way.
Correct.
So this is the first time we discussed it. We draft a letter to Delegate Albo telling him that we did it and ask Ms. Boehner to deliver it to him. Because this is, for those of you who remember, this is the Albo resolution. This is a policy that we only have, and I don't mind having it, because Delegate Albo was going to file a bunch of bills that were going to make give us a bunch of headaches if we didn't have this policy. So we're going to tell him he did it.
In fact, I do beg you.
We not only have it, we actually live by it.
Actually, I have a two-part question I'm not quite clear on. If the blue line traction power upgrades are going into the work plan, is safety a significant part of that work plan?
I'm not an expert on it, but I do know that WMATA has been working with the Federal Transit to incorporate the safety aspects in the traction power
upgrades. The traction power upgrades are required for two reasons. One is that the traction boxes themselves are aging because a lot of them are the originals. And the second is the 7000 series can only run as an 8-car train. And so there needs to be more power. So it fundamentally, it is related to safety and moving the trains efficiently. But it's also a capacity enhancement, which is important to say because our money is for enhancement of capacity, not for maintenance. And this will allow more trains to run, longer trains to run.
So is that like a chicken egg thing? They need the traction to make it safe?
To run the longer trains to carry more people, yes.
To carry more people and to make it safer.
Yes.
And in the work plan, is there a priority process how they address safety, I'm wondering?
In the WMATA work plan?
Yes.
Nobody's here, but...
We have some Metro staff. Do you want to
put
you on the spot?
New people.
I would answer that then. First point, sorry. It's very briefly, Mark Phillips, Office of Planning.
For some reason, you spoke at one of our authority meetings.
Sorry. Sorry, you weren't there, Mark, when I was there.
I was there at the tail end.
Yeah.
Passed each other along.
Yeah.
I'm not the Office of Management and Budget staff, so I can only interpret to the best of my ability. Traction Power is a large program which has both state of good repair and capacity upgrade components to it. Part of a system-wide effort that we're doing line by line, and each line improvement has both the state of good repair and safety to replace. Some of these cables haven't been replaced since the system was originally built. So the entire intent is to replace all of the existing cables and upgrade where we need to support 8-car train operations. So this is the capacity component, which MBTA is helping to fund, and there are a lot of other upgrades related to safety and state of good repair that are also being funded. Second question about the prioritization. The budget is so much a product of board negotiations, as well as staff input about what projects need to be funded and what are ready to be funded with all the different funding sources we have. For the first time in many, many years, we've created a new capital needs inventory, which is going to, I believe, will be the primary input for the first time, probably at least a decade, to the next annual work plan. As well as the 6-year CIP, which are being negotiated and worked on right now. So the CNI, I think, it's the first draft of it is almost complete, and it's going to be next year, we haven't finished the full asset inventory, but we're going to use the CNI that we have now to form the FY18 budget, and we'll have the asset inventory and an even better CNI to do the next CFA, the funding agreement between all the jurisdictions, as well as the next CNI.
So the asset inventory determines the prioritization of the lines? Is that what I'm hearing?
The prioritization of safety or the prioritization of the lines?
Well, when you make the determination, do you determine that one line is in need of work more than, say, another line? I mean, how does that work?
My understanding is that's determined by the extent of the problem that exists on the line, as well as the resources that we have already. The number of components need to be updated, as well as the funding sources that we have, and the relative age of all the different infrastructures. So the department has a multi-year plan for the traction power upgrades that spans from now all the way to 2025. So staggered depending on staff resources and financial resources. So I believe the orange line is already completed. We're working on some capacity upgrades now in Virginia, but the funding is all there. The blue line was next. The green line got the MBTA money, but it did push the MBTA award, push it up a year or two in our work.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, I just want to emphasize that, of course, what the authority is funding is capacity.
Motion from Ms. Hines. Is there a second?
Second
from Ms. Bolivar. Now all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Negative didn't change. FY18 operating budget, Mayor Parrish.
Okay, thank you, sir. First of all, I'm going to call on Mr. Logan in just a moment to help us with this, but let me say thanks to each of the members of the Finance Committee because they took this up among many other things on the 15th of December and ultimately decided to unanimously move this forward to the authority for action tonight. And in the meantime, ask staff to meet with each of our jurisdictional staff members to brief them on the budget. So with that, let me ask Mr. Longley to go through that operating budget.
Thank you, Mayor Parrish. I would like to note the budget process for all three budgets started in September with discussion of prior year guidance and confirming guidance for this year. At that point, there were proposals presented verbally and discussed. The Finance Committee met again in November where they received written proposals, and again in December, and this is the product of those three efforts. I also want to note that any unspent funds in the operating budget automatically are used to offset the operating costs for the next year. So there is no reserve in here that funds accumulate in. With that, I'll just go to item three in the staff report. And note that the operating budget is typically paid for through jurisdictions' 30% funds. Down the last paragraph on the page, we note that we're estimating to receive $327 million in revenue. The regional revenue fund will get $228.9, and PAYGO will be $98.1. On the next page, we have a breakout of the estimated 30% receipts by jurisdiction and the comparison from 17 to 18. For the rest of the presentation, you may find it helpful to actually detach the last page of this packet. On the attachment, you'll see we have noted budget notes that correspond to the base budget increases and the proposals with 4 and 5 in the letter. So I can walk through that and you can walk through each line. So looking at 4.
Can I ask a question? Do you want Mr. Longley to go through this line by line? Is there a motion that Mr. Longy go through this line item? bold font items only.
Yes.
Okay. If we look at the base budget increases, we have a series of actual decreases as well as increases, but the base budget, as you're used to in your jurisdiction, is basically what it takes for the authority to operate in 2018 as it has operated in 2017. Down at the bottom of the attachment, you'll see there's a breakout by jurisdiction and a total for the base amount for the FY18 budget. Skipping ahead, thank you. And I have been accused of cruel and unusual transparency when it comes to these budgets. I know the Finance Committee has heard that. On the proposed budget additions, moving right to those, we present again a notation on the attachment corresponding to the letter of the item being discussed. And each one of these items has a breakdown of the cost by jurisdiction. To quickly go over the communications and public outreach, we are proposing a resource that would take the form of either a part-time employee or a contract service. There is only, in the first year, there's only about a $2,000 difference between the two processes, the two approaches. The Finance Committee had a good discussion, and I think had a consensus that there is a distinct preference for a direct hire because of the flexibility it would provide and some continuity. Were we to take that approach, we want to point out that $27,000 of the $87,000 is actually for fixed cost space, furnishing, computers, things that we wouldn't have to provide were we to use a contract service. Additionally, $6,000 of those costs would be one-time costs, so a direct hire would be $6,000 cheaper in the ongoing years. We also want to note that obviously the person would not be receiving $87,000 in compensation. That was a common question or a common thing that many of the jurisdictions said, make sure you point that out. So I can't see behind me, but for those behind me, we have pointed that out. We have the breakdown by cost, by jurisdiction, or jurisdiction cost. If there's any questions on that, I can move to the next one. The multimodal baseline trains is basically funds the ability to put a supplement to the annual report that you just received. That is allows us to form a baseline and report it to show progress going over year to year. That cost is $10,000. The custody and safekeeping services and the portfolio tracking we technically put in place on the consent agenda earlier tonight. And this just treats it as for full transparency for the operating budget in 18. I do want to point out that we had a great amount of collaboration from investment staff at Fairfax County, Arlington County, Prince William County, and Loudoun County to help us select software package and come up with this program. The planning technology plan of $25,000. We have the staff resources that will allow us to do GIS mapping, and we hope to have the map so you can click on the button, and some modeling and analysis. This item was originally $35,000 when we presented it in November. We've been able to work with MDRC to do some shared resources on systems and space and bring that cost down to $25,000. The last initiative is the Transportation Planning Intern Program, and I'll succinctly state that is the Finance Committee made it pretty clear that they wanted to make sure that having an intern program was not going to detract from the staff resources, and they wanted it to be additive and a value to the students as well. And we basically, on these two pages, show that we could have the interns lifting our committee responsibilities off the full-time staff and at the same time allow them to be in the presence of the chairmen and mayors of Northern Virginia and watch the interaction as collaborative transportation agreements are made. I'll summarize at the very last page. We note each item of the six initiatives. There is an operating budget impact related to that, and so we declare the full cost of the program, of all six programs. And with that, I'll be pleased to respond to any questions.
Mr. Chairman, I move the authority adopt the proposed FY 2018 MBTA operating budget.
Second. Mr. Chairman, if I could just speak to the motion. I really like the way this information is laid out, so that it's easy to see how each cost item affects the different jurisdictions. So we've got it broken down according to percentages. So I really appreciate that. I think it's an excellent way of portraying the budget information for this regional organization. And I would also like to say that the 4% increase for compensation is a plug number that ordinarily in a regional organization, we look at how each of our jurisdictions are adjusting compensation for our employees and attempt to, you know, to try to find, a way of, reflecting that.
The Finance Committee did request that we come back with that analysis before the start of fiscal year.
Right, before it's actually implemented. So anyway, I think this is really good work, and I especially like the way it's laid out for each member jurisdiction to see the effects of the different programs that have been suggested.
Anything else? Mr. Fizette, sorry.
Yeah, so just a comment, and that is when I look at budgets, usually you see a percentage in the change.
Yeah.
And at first I thought I was going to suggest we do that in the future. But what? That percentage causes a lot of problems sometimes. You know, you start something new, even if it's 20,000 or 10,000 or 6, and it's 100% increase. No, seriously,
yeah, right.
But normally you look at it and you ask for that, and it gives you some sense, a quick sense. These percentages are about our contribution, not about the increase. There's probably some value in it as it relates to, the salaries, as you say, or maybe the bottom line. But I think I have found that when you put it in for every line, even the smallest of increases, when it's a small number to start with, ends up distracting the whole conversation to very small amounts of money oftentimes. So I'm going to take this lesson back to every place this because it's somewhat effective.
Chairman, I would just say I really appreciate the clear description of what each one of the changes is supposed to do.
Right.
And, in ordinary people language, so I commend you on that. I think sometimes that's really hard to do.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Electronic participation in meetings. Ms. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Governance and Personnel Committee actually bring three policies to you this evening for your approval. This one was prompted. We have an existing policy that allows for electronic participation at the authority meetings, but does not allow for it at the committee meetings. And I suspect all of us who chaired committees have hit these snags where somebody gets stuck and they could get on the phone, they participate, but they can't. And so we worked with staff and with the Council of Councils to expand the policy to apply to committee meetings. You're allowed two passes for each of the things that you sit on, so you could call in twice to each of your committees. I will note, though, that the quorum has to be physically present. So if we lose our quorum, then we're done for, but at least it allows someone to call in. So I would, at this point, move approval of the policy.
Second.
Discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Mr. Chairman, if I may just make a statement, I think I'm correct here, and so if I'm wrong, let me know. But I think if the same proviso applies to this meeting,
yes.
we must have a quorum in the room
yes.
in order to first allow someone to call in.
That's right, which means I can never call in.
That's right.
That is true.
You should vote no.
She said chair.
And then you,
to be fair, Mr. McKay can sit in the chair while she participates by phone.
You could.
Oh, no, you're right.
Yeah.
You don't make up the quorum. You just make up the majority.
Yes.
On the vote.
You can leave the room, and we can still continue talking about anything we want.
We just can't vote on it.
But we can vote on it. It's only a
filibuster.
Okay. Yeah. You can vote by electronic participation.
I didn't mean to start that.
You can vote by electronic
participation.
Yes. You have the form. You can do it.
Okay.
And you also have designated.
Okay.
And I also have a designated.
Okay.
All right. So the next policy is, I would say, if I had to describe this, this is additional guidance to our staff beyond the requirements of FOIA. As it pertains to candidates for office who are not members of the authority who may be asking. Oh no, I'm doing the wrong one. Sorry. This is the one that just outlines how our staff can still be political creatures without violating the rules of work. Sorry.
And this is basically consistent with what almost all of our jurisdictions do.
Exactly.
So there's big deviation. No one's got like rules to let your staff like campaign to work.
So,
I'll second it.
And I'll second it.
Please.
If an employee feels that a determination is not correct, what's their redress of grievance? And I'm thinking specifically of number Roman numeral 3. It says, nothing in this section shall prohibit the MBTA from determining whether any employee's participation or going blah, 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 blah. If the employee does not agree with the determination, is there a next step, or is that final?
The last sentence of item F allows an employee to use any other policy provisions. There is a step up discipline type of thing in our employee handbook. But ultimately, it's a very short road from particular staff person to the executive director.
That would be, wouldn't that be specifically for terminated employees?
Yes.
This one didn't give me the impression that it applied to terminated employees, just those who received a determination that they disagreed with. Or is there a distinction there?
In some of our previous policies, and I can't quote which policy, if there is a decision made, and it, because we're so small, it would really fall on Mr. Longby as a CFO/HR manager to make the decision. If the employee disagreed with that, then they would have to appeal to me. And then, unfortunately, if that doesn't work out, it may have to be brought to the full authority.
I see. So there would be a redress of grievance there. Okay, thank you.
Yes, all in favor, please say
aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
No.
This is the one I started to talk about. This is basically, as I said, an guidance to the staff around providing information to candidates who may be seeking it about the authority's work. It doesn't replace FOIA, it's additional guidance. And I would say several of our jurisdictions, but not all, have something like this or have a practice like this in place. Key points I would say is the staff does not develop new information as a result. And particularly if a meeting is set up, there's a provision here that would open that meeting to others who might be interested to get the information, and written information would be shared with others who are candidates for that same office. So I move approval of this.
Okay.
I'll second the motion, and let me just ask a couple of questions also. So part of what is required is for people to make their request in advance in writing so that there is an understanding of what is going to be discussed.
Absolutely. We would ask for the request to be in writing, number one, so that there is no misinterpretation of what the request is and that we could have a record of that.
And recommendation here is that the person who is a candidate and is asking questions, that information, the answers would be shared with others who also are running for that office.
Even if they did not ask.
Even if they did not ask. And so let me just ask a question. How difficult do we think that that will be? We are a small organization, but we include mayors and chairs of jurisdictions, but also members of the General Assembly. Usually, each of us might have an opponent or two, not that much more.
I did jump the policy.
How difficult do we think, and do we have a capacity to be able to do that?
Well, first, it was the intent to share with whoever's running, whether they ask for it or not. We would definitely post it to the website. And we also list in here that we would solicit the help of the jurisdiction because they may have more of a gauge of who is running for what. Right now, it hasn't been a problem where we've been inundated with requests for information from candidates running for office. We've had a few. But we haven't, it's nothing to the point that it's really taken away from staff time to answer the question. We just want to make sure that the authority staff, that we remain nonpartisan, impartial, and that no one can accuse us of otherwise. But to answer your question, Chairman Bulliver, we can't authentically say how difficult it would be if we were inundated with.
I think we just want to watch.
That's right. And we did talk about this in the committee, Sharon, and we sort of, at one point we considered, did Monica, did we have to put in the policy that the executive director would alert the chairman about, and what we ended up sort of saying was, yes, the executive director should pay attention. And if this becomes burdensome, then it has to basically get moved to a different level, and we would have to.
This, unlike the last policy that we just voted on, this seems to be a departure from jurisdictional policies, at least my jurisdiction. If my opponent wanted to ask a question of our executive director, and he did, the executive director was able to meet with him. He wasn't able to produce any new information.
That's correct.
And if the information had been available publicly, he wasn't then tasked with calling me and the other two opponents to give them the information that the first candidate asked.
Let me jump in. I think that there's a little confusion here. Many members of this authority are elected officials and therefore from time to time candidates for office. Questions that members of the authority ask in the regular order of business of being representatives to this body do not get answers to the people running against us. The question would be, candidate X running for delegate in Prince William County asks a question, candidate Y who's challenging them gets the answer too, so that we're not being accused of aiding in the campaign. I mean, and obviously, this. I'll look to Mr. Dickerson, and actually, this policy is very similar to Arlington and Prince Williams, correct? I actually think, I'm betting, Mr. McGuise, that Arlington and Prince Williams policies were written by the same person.
No, they actually came up with it on their own.
I think you wrote one and then changed jobs.
One of the
few. It's designed, it doesn't apply to us. I think if one of us asked a question that was clearly campaign related in nature, it could kick in. But
Mr. Chairman, I understand that it doesn't apply to us in the normal order of business. That I understand. This just is it's a departure from what I know to be in, at least in my county, that if candidate A asked a question and candidate A took it upon themselves to ask that question and it's not new information being produced and, you know, it's not burdensome to staff, then staff has no obligation to give it to candidate B, C, and D, because in some ways that could be seen as giving in candidate B, C, and D, who didn't take it up on themselves to ask a question, a hand up also.
I think it's also important, if this is in the section that's titled Meetings with Candidates for Office, and it really is about, you know, somebody, because basically, I mean, the first level response is, go to the website, you know, search on this term, right? That's the first level response to most of these questions. Shouldn't require a meeting. But on occasion, I think you have requests for meetings where people really want to sit down and understand it in complexity. And it is that section, that it is that activity, the request for a particular meeting, where it says the staff will do a brief written summary of what transpired at the meeting, that would be shared. It's not, you know, it's that specialized thing that could potentially happen, where I think the risk to our staff, as Murray says, of hearing both sides, yeah, is most relevant.
I would also say this goes back to the phrase you've heard me use many times, congestion relief is job two, right? Job one is transparency. The truth is there's very little that someone could ask about the authority that they could not find on their own, and I'll compliment staff on this. We've got a rocking website. There's very little they could ask for that's not already there. But we said from the beginning, we're going to be a highly transparent organization, and what gets you in trouble is not letting people know things. That's the thing.
Mr. Chairman, just a question. As in FOIA, you're not responsible for or required to develop information for a question, and I assume that's the same
absolutely
in this
right
policy.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
And much of your answer when you're meeting with someone is to refer people
to
the website, you know, so that information is easily found, but if somebody is not quite sure how to navigate the website, maybe something that, you know, that they're trying to understand.
Is that the definition, legal definition of candidate? I mean, we keep talking about each member of the commission is at some point in time potentially a candidate, but when you're a member of the commission, you're not considered a candidate by this. Does it say that there? I mean, honestly, I would think a candidate is a candidate. So I'm just wondering if it is, in fact, clear.
That's a good point, because as members of the authority, we have conversations that the average person would not have or think of.
Yeah, that's what you said. No, and that's actually, isn't that stated in here, that it's a given that members of the commission
does not say that. And I think it's important to say in the course of doing their business as a commission.
So I would say that I have received questions from authority members who were running for office. However, they're authority members. I don't know if you're asking to, because you're running for office, I take it that you're an authority member. You're asking a question about one of our funding programs, and here is the answer.
May I suggest, let me frame and type a little bit. From my perspective, and I'm one of the sources of this, I said we need to have a policy on this. And this is modeled in part on the Prince William's policy, where it doesn't come up often. From my perspective, the purpose is not to create more burden. This is about giving staff cover. Everything about this is, first and foremost, we have to comply with FOIA. We have to give the information. Whether we have this policy or not, we have to give the information, because that's FOIA. The value of this policy has little to do with protecting candidates. A candidate who asks a question gets an answer to their question, whether they're a member or because they're a citizen. The the functionality of this is making sure that staff doesn't find themselves in the awkward position of being asked, why didn't you tell someone about this? It gives them guidance. And when there's a gray area, we have staff that has demonstrated good judgment in the past, and I suspect would in the future, where it's a gray area. If we need to clarify it, we need to clarify it.
I'm thinking, you know, we do have an excellent website, and perhaps there could also, and I'll leave it up to staff to look at this, but perhaps during an election cycle, some kind of statement could be given to candidates that questions and answers, you know, that are received or posted on the website, something like we do budget Q&A that way. And anybody, any member of the board who asks a question, it gets posted up there for everyone to see what they asked and what the answer is. So, I don't know, having some kind of a policy where, you know, where there's been a question that can be viewed on the website for a period of time.
And earlier, just to follow up, I mean, I will say overall, I didn't even know we had this policy.
But come up
it doesn't, and that issue of who a candidate is seems a little, like you could get some question about that. But if I would relate back to what Phyllis was originally bringing up, to me, if we just to ask staff to send it out to everyone, if you want to do it, it's fine. It's not going to happen that much. To me, posting it. Somebody said earlier, it would be posted. To me, that's sufficient. Rather than mailing it out or sending it out in hard copy, but just if there is such a capturing of a meeting or writing something in a reference to something, because it's not new information, it's just directing them.
Yeah.
If there were a permanent place on the website where such information was posted, that to me would feel sufficient.
That's nice there for everybody to see.
Right.
Then do you notify the person's opponent that that information is there?
What is suggest this? Let's take a look.
Let's
take a look at this.
We'll
got lots of questions.
We'll bring this back after the General Assembly session. Our committee's not going to meet before.
Excellent.
Okay. We'll bring this back in. All right.
Okay. Next items. Items 19, 20, and 21 are appointments / reappointments to our various standing committees. I'm gonna move this to next month only because I haven't. There is going to need to be some changes in some of these, and I believe, and I haven't just talked to all of the parties. So I'll just quickly put this off next month. That's what I'm talking about. So we'll move on. The next item is the executive director's annual performance evaluation. We'll take that up after closed session. So we'll defer that for a moment. The next governance and personnel legislative update.
Yes, you have our committee report, and Spinard is here to give us a brief legislative update.
Good evening. Happy to be here with you, and it's going to be brief because General Assembly just started yesterday. And most of the bills aren't yet posted. They have until January 20th to introduce legislation. I am going to go over, you've got in the blue is the chart, and we tried to wait to the very last minute to close out the chart so we have as many bills as possible. But I do want to go over about five bills with you very quickly that have been introduced. Regarding those bills that would impact operations of the authority, there are two bills which we've seen before. House Bill 2120 from Delegate King and Senate Bill 921 from Senator Peterson, which would increase the number of non-legislative citizen members from 2 to 3, and then designate that the new seat would be elected official from a town.
Yay.
Well, now that the yay has been said. So, and see, Mr. Foreman, we're here, we have to talk about because he already knows what I'm going to say. But we're glad to have you. This bill's a real problem, actually. And it comes up every single year. And Mr. Peterson every single year says to me, you know, Marty, you're really against this. Maybe I should file it next year. And he never remembers in December that he said that to me in March. this bill actually is probably unconstitutional. And there's a reason that as much as we love our towns, there's a reason that the town representative on this commission does not have a vote. And that is because there's only one town representative on this. There's two reasons, actually. One is, if we have, if the town representative is a voting member, then we have, then under the law, we have given a vote to the citizens of one town, Leesburg, but not to the people of Vienna, Herndon, Purcellville, and Dumfries. And that could, and while Mr. Foreman used to very quickly say, yeah, but we would always talk to each other as mayors about how to vote on something controversial, I'd say, right, Jerry, but the minute that it's a situation where Dumfries comes out ahead and someone else comes up behind, I know what you're going to do. And again, and so the other issue is this, though. Each of our towns is part of a county, and every county has a vote. And unless you reduce the voting strength of the county whose town has a vote on the authority, then the citizens of that town not only have a vote that the others don't have, the citizens of that town have two votes while the other towns only have one.
This is in our legislative package, not support this.
And this is how you know, because this year, because it's Leesburg, I would support this. Last year, it was Dumfries, I would not have.
Well, guess what? Last year was Dumfries, I still didn't support it.
And those of us who have no challenge wonder why sometimes people get two votes.
I will share House Transportation Subcommittee 3. Sharpest minds in the General Assembly.
There you go.
Because I wake up at 4 in the morning, drive for 2 hours, show up, and they go, you want us to kill this one, right? And I go, yes.
That's right, 7:30 in the morning, man.
That other bill, then they say, okay, stick around, we got a bill we're going to pass in a minute. And I get mad at it. The point that I think, and I just say this every year because it is always an issue, and we want people to understand it. I want the public to understand it. Other issue that comes into play is the legislation that created the authority explicitly anticipated this problem and addressed it by mandating that we have the PCAC so that every town would have a voice that is officially sanctioned by the authority to make comments and to also provide to we, the authority, a level of peer review from fellow elected officials who review this and sort of make sure that we're staying on the right track and consistent with the values of our jurisdictions. So.
All right. Next up is also a bill that we have seen before, Delegate King's House Bill 2121, which inserts language allowing either the 30% that goes to localities or the 70% of revenues that are spent by the authority, that one of the, there's a new use added, and that is new sidewalk projects. I know this has actually gotten a lot of opposition from members of the General Assembly who created 2313 and who created the authority. They tend to not look very highly upon that addition.
The truth is, we actually have the authority to fund sidewalks right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. They just have to be rated under HB 5. Right. And they would under this, if this bill were to pass, they would still need to be rated under HB 589. And recognizing that pedestrian facilities, such as those on the Memorial Bridge between Arlington and Georgetown, are an excellent source of congestion relief.
Key Bridge,
I'm sorry. When a second pedestrian facility that relieves as much congestion as Key Bridge comes along, I'm 100% sure we'll fund it. Thus far, we have not seen
it. And then the last bill that's, again, currently been posted, I think there will be more that will be coming, is Delegate Lemonian's House Bill 2137, which deals with the authority's development of a regional plan. And it has several elements, the first of which is that requires the authority to consider every 5 years of updating its regional plan. Number two, to explain how said plan would achieve congestion congestion reduction objectives. To then require the authority to note any obstacles to achieving the reduction objectives, and if there would, particularly if there are need of others to cooperate. And then the fourth new language is, the currently local governments are required to tell the authority when there are land use decisions that might change the effectiveness of a new facility. That information would now have to be posted on the authority's website. And that's the end of the requirements of the bill.
That's it?
That's it.
It's just the first one.
That's it.
You shall mine.
Anyone want to comment on this?
No.
Tracy, we have a phone call tomorrow, right?
Yes, we have a phone call tomorrow to go over any new things that have come up and to talk about this bill. But I just want to let you know that is going on.
I'll ask this question. I chimed in too. Is there any? I heard Mr. Parrish, no one's telling us. Is there anyone who's enthusiastic about Delegate Mullins HB 2137? We'll talk tomorrow.
All right, no problem.
One question.
Sure.
Back on the sidewalk one, has anyone told Delegate King what you told us?
I think when this came up last year, I think we did.
That's the one you said you've talked to him about.
Yeah, no, well, no, the town one. Delegate Keem also usually follows the town bill.
Yeah,
but he doesn't fight real hard for it because he kind of knows.
Right. But he fought on the sidewalk for the last year.
He fought on the sidewalk for the last year. We've talked about it. I'm going to make a statement, and this is not critical. I believe that I will say that this authority has spoken to him about it. The town of Vienna has also spoken to him about it and told him they want more sidewalks. So that's,
got it. I got it.
I mean, that's okay. It's in the town of Vienna's legislative package that they should have.
On the side of smart scale, there are already, there's one bill that asks for two projects to be exempted from smart scale. From House Bill 1831, co-patrons Kilgore and Killian, requesting that the Coalfield Expressway and the U.S. Route 460 projects not have to go under smart scale analysis. I'm pretty sure the administration will take the lead in trying to kill that bill.
Can we next for? I don't want to kill this. I'd like to have an amendment and add Metro to it too.
Add what?
Add Metro. Coalfield, 460, and Metro.
And Metro. That's gone. Well, yeah.
every district is going to add. That's what 28 there too.
The other smart scale bill that's popped up is Senate Bill 921, co-patroned by Senator Edwards at Roanoke and Delegate Kay Corey, and it adds a new criteria. The new criteria would be travel time reliability, not defined. The paragraph that talks about at minimum what the analysis goes over would read congestion mitigation, economic development, adding travel time reliability, accessibility, safety, and environmental quality.
It's being driven by the 81 corridor, where they don't have congestion, but they have these accidents which create... Yeah, so it's really safety.
But isn't their region have safety as a measurable criteria?
They do,
criteria?
But I believe that that they feel that this is not... that safety is not doing its job in terms of getting sufficient dollars into their region.
We're going to have more. There's going to be more bills.
Oh, there's more
trying
coming.
To tweak smart scale.
There's more coming.
Every region wants
smart scale.
Absolutely. Except us. We think it's great.
So there's more coming. There's definitely more coming. These are probably the two most benign ones. And then last but not least, just wanted to bring to your attention, the Metro-related bills are starting to fly in. We do have the Safety Commission bill is in. Delegate Lemonian is the chief patron of it.
Is that the number yet?
Yes. Thank you. So that bill is in, but we've also got several bills or study resolutions dealing with the existing compact. For example, Delegate Lamanian has House Resolution 617 in, which is requesting the governor to engage conversations with the other jurisdictions of the federal compact about fixing the current compact. We have Delegate Minshew's House Bill 1847, which goes to, everything they hate in the compact. Again, more to come. No surprise, it's going to be a very strenuous discussion about Metro in the General Assembly. I do believe, though, that there is a deep understanding and commitment that they understand that the Safety Commission bill has to come out fairly clean, which is why I think you have separate bills dealing with the existing compact. So these are statements that they want to make, part of being campaign season, part of real concern about Metro, and frankly also I think to feed in to the federal government as Congresswoman Barbara Comstock works on whatever she's doing. So this is just going to be the start of that discussion. We'll share with you all as those bills come in what they're saying.
Can I ask a question, Mr.
Chair? Sure.
So the Metro is obviously two states and the district.
Mm-hmm.
So the compact, if they pass legislation in Virginia to change the Metro compact, what does that mean for, what does that mean for D.C. and Maryland, and how do we change a compact when we have a district and another state involved?
There's actually a little piece of the current compact now, which is based on a bill Virginia passed and the other two jurisdictions didn't deal with. So essentially what would happen is if something should pass in Virginia, it would get attached to the back of the compact, but it's not enforceable because the other two jurisdictions haven't adopted it.
Oh, I see. Can I follow up, Ebsolis? But then it would not keep, let's say next year, through this year, there's an effort to find a dedicated funding source.
Sure.
Let's say part of that is addressing and opening the compact. Let's say all that happens in 12 months. If something passes here that is one of these addendum, it does not interfere with the opportunity to come to an agreement among the three localities?
Right, I would agree. I would agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah, good. The compact, as you know, can be amended at any time. It's just that all three of them have to then adopt the same amendment. So, Virginia passing something that is never even discussed by the other jurisdictions means nothing.
Because
it really doesn't. It's more paper.
The funding sources are completely different than the other jurisdictions.
Right, and I think that's part of the discussion. The regions, the federal government, that we're all sort of thinking through our heads. And again, I think it's going to be a year-long effort. One, to acknowledge the current system is very, very different because of jurisdictions. Then if you're going to have a dedicated revenue source, even that might have to be different because of the jurisdictions are different. And then, of course, there's the question of how do you bring the federal government in as a more significant financial player, and what would be the trade-off to make that happen? Again, our adopted legislative policy speaks to both actively wanting to get the federal government more involved from financially, and also wanting to look at having a revenue source that's stable for Metro. So I just think these are part of discussions that are going to have to happen. They'll be painful. People may say things that we don't think are helpful with the overall discussion, but I think there are folks, though, who very much do, in their way, support Metro and feel that there are things that have to be fixed.
So let me just put a bow tie on it. So what we're basically saying is if something passes, it becomes an addendum at the back and is not really enforceable at this time anyway. And for it to be enforceable, the district, Maryland, and Virginia will all have to look at the compact together and decide on the beats that would be enforceable across all three
although we have different funding sources?
Yes.
All right.
I would just say I think there's a small amount of danger in Virginia passing something that hits on too many of the hot button issues, that potentially ties the hand of the negotiation around what happens, because it's really the governor and the secretary's office that are going to have to negotiate. And if the General Assembly has passed something that is sort of veto-proof, it really changes how Virginia plays in the conversation. And so to me, that's the danger of, well, it's just an addendum.
Yep, that's right.
In fact, if they did something veto-proof, I think it could be, could really make solving this much more difficult.
There's at least one bill's been introduced. Doesn't affect our funding, but as you remember, there's the gas tax floor issue for Hampton Roads and NVTC. And there's actually a Northern Virginia person has actually introduced a bill to try to address that. I'm not sure that's going to go anywhere unless Frank Wagner, senator from Virginia Beach, gets behind it. I want to say Simon. Oh, here we go. I'm sorry. Nope, it was Chap Peterson.
Who's Simon?
That's one more vote than I thought we'd get.
So we'll see, the bill was a bill passed the Senate last year. It's the House that was the problem. And I'm not getting any warm and fuzzies from the majority in the House that they want to address this issue this year. They know eventually it has to be addressed, but I don't think anybody's spending any real political capital getting it done.
I'm hoping gas prices will go up a little more, so that the floor is less impactful.
Yes.
Which what they're really hoping for is the gas prices will go up enough, not back to $4 a gallon, but up enough that they can say, how about we just set the floor at where it is today? And it's still less money than you had a couple years ago, but it's still more money than you had. But it's still a floor.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what it is.
It's just setting a floor.
And Saudi Arabia's doing the best right now.
Yeah.
I mean, they're cutting. No, horrible for 99.99% of the population, but for the other 0.0001%, and those of us who are on this commission, and these commissions, it's great.
That's great. So as I said, it's still very early days. There's a lot of stuff we're kind of expecting to see. And we'll see it sooner rather than later, but I will be working with the Governor's Personnel Committee and with Monica to make sure. There's some bills that we'll probably have on the list that we'll just be monitoring. There's some statewide tax issues that might actually bring more money in from, say, TOT, but I don't expect those bills to actually get adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I ask one more question. Do you know anything about Mr. LaRocque's... Yeah, I've read it. The constitutional amendment.
Oh, he's been several years now. He's seeking to do the lockbox on the transportation trust fund. His belief is that unless there's a constitutional amendment, you can't fully protect transportation funds from being spent on anything else but transportation. So he's been working really pretty much since he's been elected, trying to get the agreement to put on the referendum a constitutional amendment that would put the lockbox around
transportation
funding to protect it.
Sure.
Any other questions? Okay, excellent. Thank you.
It seems to me that NVTA has already been subject to a lot of controls in terms of criteria. So to the extent that anyone wants to add any more, it should be really seriously discussed. Might see even if it looks good, an additional limitation on our ability to function in the plan. The second point is I'd hope we'd be as positive as we could about these gas tax floor bills. They're hugely important, and I know you were quoted as saying something on it, and I much appreciate that.
No. I feel the gas tax floor is the most important thing for transportation in Northern Virginia. That importance doesn't translate into optimism, but it's
okay.
And the worst part about it is it was a practical matter typo. Every member of the General Assembly, including the ones who tell me they will never vote for it, tell me they wish they had done it when they put the statewide gas tax. That's the crazy thing. We said, yeah, we were supposed to have done it when we did the statewide, but we just forgot. Then do it now. Oh, no.
And I guess the point is that the failure to act is a tax. Because you either have to make it up from the general fund or you cut services, which means people can't get to work. So, I mean, one way or another, there's a cost to inaction, which we ought to try to emphasize. Thanks.
Well, you would think with the two largest economic regions being affected by it, Hampton Roads and us, it would be somewhat of a no-brainer to address it. But as Marty knows, it's not.
Finance Committee, anything else, Mr. Parrish?
Not a thing, sir.
Okay. Mr. Longy, anything else to report to us tonight? Ms. Backman, Executive Director's report.
It's in the packet,
Mr. Chairman. Just two quick items for Chairman's comments. First, I said it earlier, but I would welcome officially our newest member.
Thank you.
Kelly Burke, you've been on council for one term before this?
Two.
Two terms before this. And not a stranger, you've been here for some public hearings.
That's true.
So welcome to the board. And, I'm trying to figure out, is this Mr. Strongbridge's last meeting?
It will be.
Well, it takes them a couple of days to certify the election, then, doesn't it? Or you're just not coming with them?
This certainly might be my last meeting. Yes. When's the next one? February?
Our next meeting is February 9th. That's why I asked earlier. Your last is February 7th.
I think the incoming mayor, whoever she or he may be, may want to get a head start in representing the city of Fairfax on this august body.
Excellent. So. It was that bad.
Huh? Yeah. Well, really enjoyed my distinguished and long service on there. I do want to publicly thank Wendy Sanford from our staff, who has been very helpful in helping me get to speed. And I would just hope that the next mayor is as compliant as I've been in voting with the chairman and the staff.
Well, we truly appreciate your willingness to serve both this authority, certainly, but also your jurisdiction. You swooped in at an opportune time.
An important time.
Yes. Important time.
So that very thought makes it sort of a boring meeting, right?
Thank you.
Okay, we have one item to discuss in closed session. I will now recognize a motion to go into closed session for the purpose of discussing one personnel matter pursuant to Virginia Code Section 2.2-3711-1A. Moved by Ms. Randall, seconded by Ms. Bulova. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you, everybody. We're back in. We need to certify the closed session. I will now recognize a motion to certify that only matters discussed in closed session were those announced in the motion to enter into closed session pursuant to Virginia Code Section 2.2-3711-1A.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Parrish, seconded by Ms. Hines. All in favor?
Aye.
Are there any objections? Do we have to roll call that one? Or is, yeah. Is consent enough? Ms. Hines, the motion.
Thank you, I do. I move that the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority approve an amendment to the Executive Director's Employment Agreement in accordance with the terms discussed by the authority at its just concluded closed session and authorize the chairman to execute the contract amendment reflecting those terms in a form approved by council.
Second.
Motion is second. Any discussion? I'll say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. That's it. I will now recognize Mayor Strombers for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
We have a second.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
You're adjourned. Thank you very much.